Hello and welcome to another edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. One of the things I don't do enough is speak to people doing difficult things. I don't mean brain surgery, but things that could, if done properly, change our muddled and often sad society. How is it that with so much pressure and corruption and so much poverty and such poor leadership, how is it that we are still standing? I think it's because of our private sector, because it's strong. Not just because, as President Cyril Ramaphosa has already recognized, the private sector, not the state, creates jobs. There's more. Doing my research, such as it is for this interview, I discovered that South African corporates spend more than 10 billion rand a year on corporate social investment, CSR. It could be anything from sponsoring a marching band to providing scholarships to good universities, but I've been sure for a long time that this silent spend makes a much bigger difference than we appreciate. My guest today will know that feeling of satisfaction, I'm sure. Setlogane Mancidi is the head of corporate social investment at Investec, my bank, by the way, and it's a pretty decent bank, I have to say. Anyway, that's not the point. I don't get paid for advertising here, Setlogane, but running something clearly socially useful for a corporate able to put money behind you must have its incredibly satisfying moments. Am I right?
I tell you what a privilege it is, Peter, to doing what you love doing, but also aimed at the development of others, supported by the financial and corporate muscle, broadly, of an entity such as Investec.
Well, you're very lucky. You know, we're going to particularly talk about, as I was saying, I mean, corporate social investment takes many forms and different shapes and sizes and levels of enthusiasm and levels of seriousness. We're going to talk about skills development and education here mainly. Just tell me just briefly what, in your job, what does Investec want you, what gaps does Investec want you to fill and how do you choose them?
Well, I think, Peter, the most difficult thing here is that our broader vision through corporate social investment is enabling people to become active economic participants in society. And that's really key because it's part and parcel of facilitating inclusion and the likes. Now, the most important thing is how do you enable people to become active economic participants? There are a number of ways that you do so. And we focus largely on entrepreneurship and education. That is key. It's a very important piece. Because that's the way in which people become active economic participants in society. It doesn't mean that we're oblivious to the many things that exist in society, not at all, but rather that we understand that if we are to really empower people, we've got to teach them how to fish as opposed to giving them the fish.
So just give me a concrete example of what you would then do. How do you find people to teach to fish?
So let me give you some form of examples. The one is one around maths and science education in our country, which is a very challenged space and leads to the scarce skills kind of focus and area, which is key in many ways than one. And one of our flagship programs is called ProMaths. And in essence, what ProMaths does is it's extra maths and science tuition over weekends, school holidays, and the likes to a select few of schools. So we've got about 10 centers or sites across the country with a capacity of about 5,000 learners in grades 10 to 12 giving the support. And in essence, we partner with the schools themselves. Nobody can walk off the streets and say, I want to be part of ProMaths. The schools are the ones that say, here are kids, they feed the schools, and we choose one central location, and they come and attend there. And we matriculate about 1,200 a year, and we contribute and have been for the past 5 years or so, at least 5% of the distinctions in maths and 6% of the distinctions in science come from this base, a very small base for that matter. But this is awesome because it's indicative of the fact that potential is in all of us. You know, you don't have to go to Bishop's or St. John's or any of the other private schools to achieve the kind of results that we get. I mean, we move kids from 20% sometimes 30% to 90% or even 100% medicine science. And that has seen people produce amazing results. But I think most important is not about producing amazing results. I often say, yes, we celebrate the results. But actually, the key question is, what do they go to do with those results post matriculating and getting into varsity and graduating, which is awesome because a huge number of those end up being employed. Others even start in their own businesses and the likes. But yeah, the key point is we're after enabling people to become active economic participants. And that's one way through education that we do so.
But Setlakhani, so once you've identified somebody and you've said find them in grade 10 and you put them through, you know, you've got them a good maths mark in matric and you've seen them. Do you follow them through university? I mean, do you?
Yeah. So we do. I mean, so we've even started what we call a Promets Bursary Fund. So this bursary fund, which last year, for example, gave about 74 full cost bursaries to youngsters who would have just come through this program. It's ring-fenced just for beneficiaries of this program. But besides that, some of them go into mainstream bursaries and other bursaries otherwise. And we even have established Promets alumni chapters at universities because that's important. So creating a home away from home, a sense of support, and ensuring that they make it out the other end within record time. And every now and then, we do independent reviews or studies of the program, including of where our students are, what difference are they making, and the likes. And that's it. What we're really after is the fact that not only did they produce those results, they end up becoming active economic participants in society. And that's key. And that's why relevance is important, because it's not about just broadening access. It's about broadening access, yes, but supporting in a particular space that or leads to scarce skills qualifications being pursued.
How many people are we talking about here? I mean, let's just take a freeze frame of today. How many people from high school through university, possibly into entrepreneurship or management, how many people are still, you know, on your radar?
At any one time, I would say anything between 2,000 to 4,000 within our radar.
Now, let's assume that other corporates are doing similar things. We were talking before we started about the extent to which people do different things. In other words, and it's difficult to arrive at a sort of a national push for, say, math skills or welding skills or whatever it might be. Do you belong as a corporate social investment officer, that you belong to a group of people in business in South Africa? Do you talk about what you're doing and offering, or is it very much a, you know, company driven thing? Every company does what they do in their own way with their own people and with their own targets.
Peter, I think the most important recognition is that actually there isn't a common vision that we all work towards. We're talking, we do, engaging, we do, sharing lessons, sharing case studies, we do, but not to the extent of collaborating and working towards one common vision. You'll find that companies all drive their different strategies. But in the main, you will find that education forms a huge part of what various corporates focus on, albeit at different levels. Others would do early childhood development, others would do teacher development, others would do, you know, it spans across a number of different spaces as championed by the businesses as they see fit. Yes.
Can I ask you also, just in the case of Investec, how seriously does the bank take your job? In other words, are you stuck in a small office in the basement, or do you get to talk to the CEO when you need to? I mean, what's your budget?
I mean, we manage anything between 90 and 100 million annually. But I do feel heard, listened to, recognized, supported. I mean, I've been with Investec for 19 years now. Now, Peter, I want to say to you, if I didn't feel as supported, as engaged, as heard, as seen, And then the extent to which our purpose is very clear. I mean, this is a purpose for the broader bank, which is creating enduring worth living in and not of society. So it's very much embedded in our DNA. So this is part and parcel of who we are, and it's hugely supported.
How do you know when you're getting it right? I mean, how do you know that you've got it right, that you're concentrating in the right way, that your program is the right thing for you to, that's the right way to spend your annual 100 million rand?
You know, Peter, the difficulty is, I often say to people, in the South African context, if I put 101 people in a room and I said to them, what kept them, or what keeps them awake at night on the socioeconomic front, there'll be 101, if not 202, if not 303, very legitimate causes to support. And therefore, the difficulty with in our space is we have to say no more than we can say yes, not because the causes are not worthy of support, but simply because you've really got to think long and hard around the degree of focus and what informs your focus. So a huge part of what informs our focus is a lot more around the vision of enabling people to become active economic participants. It's also understanding that investing by its nature is not everything to everyone. And therefore, even in our CSI space, it shouldn't be. And also that if the key thing is you've got to assess behind, on the back of, to what extent is that which you're doing enabling people to become active economy participants, and the extent to which our bursary programs leads to job placements, the extent to which Promet's results leads to better access to tertiary education and has done for years, and to bursaries that people wouldn't have otherwise gotten, and pursuing degrees that they wouldn't have otherwise pursued, and then ultimately seeing them to become active economic participants in society. That's when we know, to the extent to which we support entrepreneurship efforts and the likes, and you see the extent to which businesses, the emerging businesses are growing, are starting to employ people. That's when you start seeing and saying, you know, there's something to show for it. And it's not the anecdotal stories that one tells you. It's when I can start by telling you, to the extent that I've told you already, that 6% of the distinctions in science in this country nationally come from this program. That's massive.
Listen, I'm attracted to an argument, and I did share it with you ahead of talking to you, that says that levels of education don't correlate well with the economic performance of a nation. Ricardo Hausmann of the Kennedy School at Harvard wrote a very provocative article a few years ago where he basically said that as an economic driver, education doesn't work. He said that a Harvard colleague, in the article I remember, said a Harvard colleague had concluded that in the 50 years from 1960 to 2010, global labor force average time in school tripled from 2.8 years to about 8.3 years. So, you know, what he means is that the average worker in a median country went from less than half a primary education to the more than half a high school education. But he says countries that were already at 8.3 years in 1960 were 5.5 times richer than those with just 2.8 years of schooling. But as those countries caught up to the 8.3 years, they were still left way behind. And his conclusion that something other than education is needed to generate prosperity. And I can't help thinking, just reading the article, you know, because he talks about how China started behind Tunisia, Mexico, Kenya in 1960 and has now blown everybody out of the water economically. The same can be said, he says, of Thailand and Indonesia vis-a-vis Cameroon, Ghana, or the Philippines. So these fast-growing economies must be doing something other than educating people in the formal sense, going to university, passing school, getting good grades. And I think that he's suggesting that that those fast-growing societies can do more things, even though they might not be as educated, because they've got more skills. And skills are not things you can learn in a classroom. And I just wondered, you know, skills you learn by watching somebody do something. It could be picking grapes. It could be, you know, welding the inside of a high-pressure boiler. But until you're able to up your skills level as opposed to your education level, you might be missing a big trick. And I just wonder where you find yourselves ever, or whether you ever think about the gap between the funding that you give to education and the funding that you might give to skills development.
So, I mean, Peter...
Oh, that was a very long question.
No. I got it. And thanks for sharing the article, by the way, which gave me a sense of where you were leaning. But I think there is a place for both. Right. And of course, I'm not going to talk so much in terms of economic development as such, but I think to facilitate inclusion, to make sure that people are able to end up as active economic participants in society, undeniably, education goes some way. But at the heart of all this, whether it's education, whether it's skills, it is relevance. You know, I think partly what we are dealing with here in the South African context, in particular, for example, is the fact that there is often a mismatch between what we have in terms of people who graduate, the level of employability, and what the market requires. We've got to make sure that there is a bit of adaptation in terms of ensuring that the sausage machine type of approach that we've had for years on end is something that we've really got to carefully address. And of course, in a country such as ours, with such a high youth unemployment rate, and just unemployment rate broadly, the pace at which traditional education includes people in the economy is just way too slow. And we've got to be looking at how skills development can fast-track people's inclusion in the economy, whether be it entrepreneurship-related skills development, be it IT, coding, and a whole host of others, of course. But we've got to argue that there is a place for both. And of course, sadly, we've let go of apprenticeships and a whole host of other things that may have facilitated people's entry into the economy. So I agree, and this is why we play in the spaces we play, both in the mainstream education front, but also in the entrepreneurship side of things, where we've exposed people not necessarily to traditional education as such, but to entrepreneurial kind of training, entrepreneurial kind of exposure, practice, and I've given you some sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the dropping of apprenticeships seems to me completely insane. What would possess anybody to prevent the actual passage of knowledge from one human being to another one? You know, the call is now for, or there's been a call, or the media has addressed it as a call for solidarity to find among its members or sympathizers people who know electrical engineers who can help ESCOM. And whatever the politics of that might be, the fact is that there are probably a lot of people out there who know how to fix lots of things, but who are either retired or left their jobs or taken packages or whatever it might be. But, you know, the only possible way for them to teach somebody how to fix a generator or a switchboard or a boiler is to physically show them. You cannot surely learn this stuff in a book. And you have to watch somebody, if you're an apprentice, you'd watch somebody doing it 1,000 times. And then he'd watch you doing it 1,000 times. And then you might have the skill to go and say, hey, I can fix that thing. You know, you drive, all you have to do is drive through, I don't know, rural Transkei and find out this. You can see what's broken because it's running in the streets. And all it requires is the transfer of skills. and we don't do that. And I just wonder whether there is scope for that in CSR. Not teaching coding necessarily, I'm sure it's very necessary, just teaching plumbing. You know, there was a terrible course, a story I read a couple of years ago about a course where 4,000 or 5,000 kids were signed up by the department of whatever to learn to be plumbers. There was a big sign outside OR Tambo Airport about, you know, plumbers for the future, whatever it was. And they never did anything, these poor kids. I mean, they were taken on this course, taught absolutely nothing, and then just sort of let go. And what a shame that was. Instead of being attached to a plumbing firm, subsidy from the state so that they could earn a salary and get to work in the morning. And there's nothing there. Is there anything you can do?
No, I mean, I think you're right. There's got to be a lot more effort in trying to make sure that the CSI space embraces the skills development, more vocational skills development pieces, as opposed to only just the traditional route of getting people to go to varsity. But I think we've got to take a step back, and this is where we've really got to lobby government, work with government, and this is a place for CSI to also play a part, which is that we should create exit points, Peter, in our education system. Currently, we take people through a sausage machine, as I said earlier,
yeah.
And the only outcome is to get to matric, right?
Yeah.
And this is why the education system is like a leaking funnel of sorts that constantly loses people all the way through. It's because we do not create various exit points when it makes sense, which then could possibly lead to possible other different paths, which one of them could have been vocational. So, for example, there should have been an exit point at grade 10. Why has there been no exit point at grade 10? Because not everybody should have to get a matric, yeah. Right? And then create a path that would see them pursue vocational kind of qualifications. But your TVET colleges would also talk to the same, right? And have a stronger linkage there. But
do they, I mean, I have no experience with the TVET. Do they actually teach skills? Or do people come out there qualified to, you know, pick up a blowtorch and weld two pieces of metal together?
Well, I mean, sadly speaking, which is, it goes to the same piece around employability broadly of all people who go through tertiary education in our country. It's not always as effective as it should be. And in fact, as for the TVET college, I think it's in a far worse position than the traditional universities are. And really, we've really got to do a lot of hard work in reinventing, recapacitating those colleges for this purpose. Because, again, if there's a space for ideal skills development, fast-paced, very quick-to-market kind of, the TVET colleges could lend that very a space and a lot more practical in nature. I mean, this is a similar thing. As I mean, in this country, we seem to look down on these, and which is why one of the things we shut down, which is an indictment for many years to come, was the teacher training colleges. You know, so anything else that seems to have a college linked to it as opposed to a university, be it of technology or mainstream, we look down upon. And sadly, that's our own downfall. And we really ought to look at means and ways. But the corporate sector can't do this on their own. Got to have a willing government that sees and identifies and understands this to be a priority and seeks for partnerships to best resuscitate these institutions. And we need them not tomorrow. We need them as in yesterday to be back on track.
Well, I mean, so you've got the president now saying he wants a social consensus. And we have in the corporate sense, in terms of the budget that they spend on CSI, let's say it's 10 billion rand a year. That should be a very loud voice at this consensus conversation that the president says he wants, but it won't be heard at all. You know, it'll take place at a very sort of high level of macroeconomic policy, and it won't be about teaching people to fix pipes and fix switches and electrical or change light bulbs. I mean, it will simply the great pity is that it won't go into detail, because detail is where the mistakes get made, and the you know, when the details aren't fixed, water doesn't flow, lights don't come on, and you know, I just wonder, and I'm sorry, it's not your job, but you know, if business were able to get its CSI voice heard louder, would it just be a jumble of noises, or would there be, do you think, a central helpful message to government that we could, you know, with some thought, get better results on at the level of skills? I'm not talking about education and mathematics, just how to do things.
I mean, I think there could be, and it is really more a sense of does government have an appetite to listen and to see? I mean, part of what we've always argued in many respects when I speak to my colleagues in CSI is that through the bits and pieces that we do, we've created capacity to deliver. I mean, if I was to look at the Promise example that I spoke to earlier, we've got a government partnership only in the Department of Education, with the Department of Education in the Free State. If only governments and all government departments could see this and say, here's the capacity. They themselves don't necessarily always have the internal capacity, but they may have the financial resources to come into partnership with. And that's what shifts the dial. So even in the context of the skills development, it has to be a serious threat. It is the acknowledgement, first and foremost, that as government, we don't always necessarily have the capacity to shift the dial in society. And we need to come into association and partnerships with those who can help us shift the dial. And it's not a bad thing.
Do you think the government recognizes that there is a difference between an education and a skill?
I mean, I do think we're starting to hear the Department of Higher Education through BLADE starting to make those noises, which seems to indicate that acknowledgement is there. Where NISFAS's emphasis largely has in the past been only on the traditional universities and the like, I've heard noise now being made around how do we resuscitate and how do we channel people to get into TVET colleges. And in fact, I've heard department wanting to shift mindset, because that's a big thing we've got to do amongst our youth, to say to our youth, it's not the dentist, it's not necessarily the lawyer, it's not that necessarily going to, you know, earn the most in many instances, but, you know, that you can as a plumber, as a, you know, a boilermaker, whatever it is, but more technical, make a living. And quite a decent living, and make a contribution, most important, in a country such as ours. So I think there is that appreciation. But like most things in government-related, the pace is rather slow. And maybe where it is that I will take responsibility, that we as corporate, particularly through CSI divisions, is we've got to try and fast-track that acknowledgement. That acknowledgement must be turned into activity. But you can only try.
No, you can only try. I mean, absolutely. You know, I just hope that when it comes to negotiating this new consensus or partnership in the country, I hope that people like yourself and doing the kinds of jobs that you do, and given a little bit more freedom to look around the country than perhaps your colleagues doing big deals and this kind of thing, are able to sort of put your hand up, you know, and say, look, you know, before we start signing any grand agreements with the government, let's just talk about what's happening on the ground. You know, let's get things fixed. And let's teach people. And as you say, you know, I mean, plumbing is a very lucrative proposition. If you're in the right place at the right time. And, so I presume would be lots of other hand skills simply learned. You know, brain surgeons learn how to operate on people's brains by watching other people do it. You know, there might be lessons to be learned and books to be read, but it's only watching. Only the transfer of skills can only happen between two humans. it cannot adequately happen, I don't think, in a classroom. But I'm, you know, that's just an uninformed journalist view. But Setlakhan, it's been fantastic to talk to you, and I appreciate it, and thank you for giving us, for giving me your time, and I wish you good fortune with your program. It sounds fantastic, and you know, we the country is alive because people like you do the work that you do. That's why we're still standing, so we should be grateful. I really enjoyed talking to you, Setlakhan Mancidi, head of corporate social investment at Investec. I hope people have enjoyed listening to you, and I'm sure they will. Thank you for joining me, and we'll all be back next week with another interesting guest.